Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Motor City Metrics. I am your host for right now, Chris Brown. Alongside me is Youp. We may or may not be getting a visit from Helio. He is in Minnesota right now doing a work trip. And we know a lot of other people. Maybe down in Detroit watching the draft, participating in the draft. I was actually supposed to head down there today. And I had to, in the last minute, I was literally waiting in the parking lot for my friend to pick me up. I got a call from my mother-in-law that my son had gotten sick everywhere and she was needing some help. And what's funny is, he's not a huge baseball kid. Mm-hmm. He likes football more, but there's been like three events now where he's actively prevented me from participating in football that I almost feel like is like a sign. He was actually born 2014. He was born during that year's Super Bowl. Would have been, I believe it was the Seahawks. And yeah. Broncos?
The blowout?
I think so, yeah. I didn't watch it. It was the first Super Bowl in years that I hadn't watched because I was, celebrating the birth of my child. And then a couple years later, I was getting all ready to watch the Super Bowl between the Patriots and Falcons. And wouldn't you know it, he's young, I don't know, he's three or four, gets super sick, is thrown up every 15 minutes, and so we're just taking care of him. So I miss the greatest comeback in football history. And today, I missed the draft, but it's okay. I love him, and he's feeling better now. But great. You know what? I've seen some pictures of that crowd down there, and not so much.
You know, it's kind of one of those things. Like sometimes I wonder, would I really want to be in Times Square on New Year's Eve, right? Mm-hmm. And there's some pluses and minuses there, but I think for me, especially at my age, the minuses would probably win out. And the same thing as I look at that crowd in Detroit. You know, basically you're looking at a big screen, and you can hear them. You know. Maybe there's some fun chanting going on by some of the fans and some yelling, but there's something to be said for having a big screen and a couch.
No, I mean, and that was the thing. Like, this is, oddly enough, this is one of the few things that I, with my buddies from high school, this is like the only time we ever meet up is for the NFL draft. And I'm not even a huge NFL guy, but it's just been a tradition since we were in high school. And so I was going to do it. And then this feels like a once in a lifetime thing to have the draft in your city.
Oh, that's cool. Yes. No question.
But and then my wife sent me a message that Detroit said, no more people coming downtown. No one till 2 p.m. tomorrow. We're closed. City's full. So I was like, all right, well, that's fine. So we'll sit here, and anybody who doesn't particularly feel the need to watch the draft unfold can join us for a little bit of baseball chat. We're going to recap the last three games in Tampa and maybe preview the Royal Series a little bit. And, who knows? We may do segments. We may not. We'll see. But, so Tigers take 2-3 in Tampa. Youp, any initial thoughts about what went down?
Well, my first question is for you real quick. Bench clearing situation in Erie today, right?
Yeah.
No real fight, but the bench is cleared. My question for you is this. Maybe you know, maybe you don't. Who is assigned to protect Jackson Jobe in these situations?
My guess would be R.J. Pettit.
Okay.
RJ Pettit is the 6'8", 300-pound right-hand pitcher who should put Jackson Jobe in his back pocket, and you protect him like that abominable snowman in the Looney Tunes cartoons.
If Gabe Alvarez has not set that up, he needs to do it tomorrow.
Yes.
That is your Mr. Pettit, that is your job.
Yeah. It was just some jaw, and there was a hard slide and into home, and I don't think it was on purpose, but people get upset about these things. But apparently Erie ended up with a walk-off win, which is nice. Unfortunately, I can't clip it up right now because we're live on air. But,
So anyway. Going back to the Royals, or excuse me, the Rays series. Mm-hmm. Again, win 2 out of 3. Just keep clipping along. Winning series is all we care about. It was, I heard a lot of people say Monday was one of the most enjoyable Tiger games that they've watched in years.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it. The offense was cooking. The pitching was good. There was some good defense. It was just a real fun evening of sitting around watching a ball game when your club is playing well. Then they pulled out the next game. And then last night, they were down. They came back. The offense showed some life. That was pretty cool. I thought you made one of the best online references where the home run by Curtis Mead was the softest hit home run ever.
I don't know about ever, but certainly this year so far, yes. 87 miles an hour off the bat.
And he was helped by the stupid Crawford cutout there, that little spot in the fence that they took out for Crawford, and it really worked. Carl Crawford made several incredible catches there. So that was a game that could have went either way. They just came on their short end, but you know, you had to figure Tampa would probably pull one out at their stadium.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was the Monday game, as you said. You know, you got Tarik Skubal out there just looking absolutely dominant with three hits, no walks, 9 strikeouts in 6 innings, and the offense, like you said, putting up 7 runs. You get another home run for Parker Meadows in front of the family, which was cool to see.
Yep.
But I thought, you know, Tuesday's game was pretty damn fun too. When you get to see Riley Green crush 2 home runs, and that was another comeback win, as it were. And yeah, I mean, you take the road trip as a whole, and they go 4-2 at Minnesota and at Tampa. That's, you know, you always feel like you could win more, but there's nothing to sneeze at right there. You win 2 out of 3, you're going to the playoffs.
Yes, 100%. It's funny, you know, you say, oh, we won the series. It doesn't sound that sexy, but boy, it adds up if they keep doing it. So, you know, and boy, I'll tell you, Tarik Skubal, I really enjoyed watching that outing. You know, I'm not saying Tampa's offense is, you know, first rate, but they have a few dangerous guys. And I just can't get over when he is throwing that fastball inside to right-handers. It really looks to me, it's like a visually, it's hard to describe. I feel like it's boring viciously in at those batters, but somehow it straddles the corner as well, you know, and he gets that call and he was just dominating there. That was really, really fun.
Yeah, and then, you know, we were complaining about Maeda on our last podcast, and he went out there and you know, they didn't give him any help in the first inning.
No.
But ended up getting through 5, scoreless, no walks, 5 strikeouts. I think he also gave up just 3 hits. That's kind of what you expected from him this year. It was nice to see him put together one of those outings. Yes. If you can do that a little bit more, you have to feel good about it. So that was a good sign. And then unfortunately, we got kind of the middling Jack Flaherty again on Wednesday. Now, what we've seen from him before, he seems to get in trouble early when he does, and he managed to right the ship there, but it was still, you know, I think his ERA is like 4.9 so far. So hasn't been, the strikeouts have been there, the walks haven't been too bad, but he's given up some hard contact, and you hope he can put things together a little bit better soon.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see. He has moments in every start where, boy, he looks good. You know, I mean, there's some nastiness to a few pitches that he throws. And then all of a sudden, he has these little stretches where it's very hittable. So, I don't know. That's something that Fetter is going to, I'm sure, working with him on.
Yeah. We got a little quote here. Tyler Matson said, I never knew there were any MLB outfields that short. He's talking about the 327-foot home run from Curtis Mead. You know, honestly, I think the shortest spot in any outfield is, I think, around the pesky pole in Boston, right?
I think so.
Might be short of 300 feet, actually, but you really have to have a strangely hit ball to hit a home run there. And then, you know, right field in Yankee Stadium is pretty shallow. I think you can hit like a 315, 320-foot home run there, but meanwhile, you can hit a 390-foot, 5-foot flyout to left field in Baltimore now. Yeah. It's kind of funny. There was a home run earlier. I think one of Riley Green's home runs. Maybe it wasn't him. Maybe it was Canna. Somebody. It was a home run in 29 out of 30 ballparks. And I was like, yep, I know which one that didn't count.
You know, speaking of Canna, one thing I loved about that homer on Tuesday that made it 4-2 is Detroit had been really struggling to get tack on runs, you know, and it was just nice to, you know, see that home run from Riley Green, get the lead, and all of a sudden, bang, we got another run on the board. Just to stretch that lead and give them some space for the rest of that night. That to me is always one of those things in baseball. It's hard to quantify what that's worth, but it just confidence wise, it's worth something.
You know, and I just looked at something here, you know, the Tigers have been scoring runs, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, they lost that game yesterday, but it was 5 runs, right? And, yep. And I just looked. I went back to April 14th to see how they rank. So roughly, I guess, you know, 10, 11 days. Over the last 10, 11 days, they have the seventh most runs in baseball as an offense with 49.
Nice.
You know, the Arizona is number one at 65. So they're averaging just under six runs a game. But 49 runs in 11 games, that's not bad. So maybe we're seeing the offense wake up a little bit. And, you know, I mean, one of the things we wanted to discuss is they're still waiting for Colt Keith and Parker Meadows to get out of this these doldrums there. Yep. And what's interesting is A.J. Hinch doesn't seem to have a problem playing Buddy Kennedy over Colt Keith right now. Buddy Kennedy seems to be putting together good at-bats. He made an awesome play at third base the other day.
Yes, he did.
Barehanded throw. So I'm curious how much more of that we're going to see and if that portends a potential demotion. I would not think they would do that this early, but, you know, another 10, 12 games, you're at the 40-game mark, right? So,
well, you look at the Cardinals sent down Jordan Walker, right? I mean,
yeah,
some teams are making moves. But I think it's interesting. That's what I was going to talk about as well when we got to this. The team is winning. They're successful right now. They're 14-11, which isn't great, but it certainly is pretty good. So they're not in a state of panic where they have to pull the plug on these guys, as long as they feel like it's not doing some long-term damage to them, right? Mm-hmm. So with Meadows, we know they have a first-rate defensive outfielder out there, so he is providing something to the cause. You know, he's run into a home run or two, but otherwise he's striking out an insane amount. What does that mean for him long-term? I don't know. You know, I'm not qualified to even guess really, other than it probably isn't good, but
yeah,
they are scoring runs, as you point out. So there's, to me, that really takes away the level of desperation to behind them hitting, you know, 086 or whatever he was hitting. I think they can live with it a while longer and take the defense and win games that way. If they slip below 500, maybe that changes.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I mean, the one thing you worry about is you know, strikeout rates do normalize fairly quickly.
Yeah.
Now it's we're still relatively early in the season, but Parker Meadows is striking out. It's still above 30, well above 30, right? I don't know if it's 40% yet. I mean, I have to take a look here, but
well, he went through a stretch there. He struck out like eight times and nine at bats around that home run.
Yeah, and it's still, so he's at you know, he's exactly at 40% right now, which is just that's unsustainable, even despite playing outstanding defense. And he's got a batting average on balls in play of .097. But you know, when I was looking earlier for segments, I noticed that he has the third or fourth highest average launch angle. So, you know, that could be good if you're hitting home runs, but if you're not hitting a ton of home runs, you're popping out.
Yeah.
Out. Definitely
a lot of pop-ups.
And that has been the case this year. And he's, you know, I was thinking the other day, like which Tigers hitter has the easiest scouting report for the opposing pitchers. And I was like, well, if it's Meadows, you throw him high fastballs. That's all you have to do. If you don't miss, you're fine. That wasn't the case last year in the minors. It wasn't the case last year in the majors. I don't know what's happened. I looked at it. He was just fine hitting 95 plus down in Toledo last year and was fine in the majors last year. So something's happened. There's an obvious hole that they're exploiting there.
And then again, that's another, you know, it's the fact that he could do it last year just tells me that everybody needs to slow their roll a little bit and realize it's April.
Damn.
You know, it's April and things can change. He could bust loose at any point, but he's got to prove it. He's got to be able to get a high heater and handle it. You know, I think that when he popped up last night in a kind of a big situation, right, that was a high fastball, wasn't it?
Yeah, I believe so. And that's just it really does seem like that's the easy way to get him out. And I don't know why he can't lay off it or can't get on top of it. And, you know, I remember that there were comments about him being just a mistake hitter in AAA. And it does seem so far that unless you throw it right down the middle, he's not really going to hit it. But don't know. I just, we saw so much more from him last year, and he had a relatively slow start. You just kind of hope that he gets it turned around to the point where it's, you know, it's not so rough. You're not expecting him to fail. You know, it was, like you said, it was, he had a huge, huge chance, and it was a pop-up. It was just about the worst thing you could do aside from striking out. So,
infield was in, wasn't it?
Yeah, I believe so.
Whoa.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, the other easy scouting report for me, I mean, obviously throw sliders away to Javi Baez, although he's been hitting the ball very hard lately. He was getting a lot of fastballs, but, also just pitch Spencer Torkelson away until, I don't know what it is, but he just, even back in West Michigan as a, you know, his first pro season, just couldn't hit stuff on the outer third and would lay off it. And pitchers are pretty good at targeting your weaknesses. So I don't know. We'll see. We're still waiting for him to turn it on too.
Yeah. I mean, you know, everybody wants him to get off to Schneid on the homers. Mm-hmm. And I was stunned that one he hit last night died at the fence. That thing looked like a classic home run swing. The ones that we saw, it's hard to say it's classic because it was last year, but you know, the ones we saw last year, that looked like it. I thought for sure that was gone. And who knows with that stadium, you know, why it died like it did, or if he just missed it by a hair. But you know, he's got what, 8 doubles. Last I looked, he was second in the AL in doubles. That's something. Mm-hmm. It ain't great, but it's something. And he's knocked in 11 runs. That's starting to work its way up, that number. So he hasn't been a total dead spot in the lineup like, you know, a couple of the others, but certainly been a disappointment.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Like he's finding ways to contribute on offense despite you know, not hitting those home runs. They could really use a handful of home runs from him because I don't know. It's you know, we've talked before, and this is a nice kind of segue into the upcoming series with Kansas City, as we were going to compare these young teams, this group of young hitters. We were going to compare the group of young college pitchers and the group of young hitters with the Royals and Tigers for a while. And the college pitchers, for the most part, kind of fizzled out for the Royals, other than Brady Singer. But the young hitters for the Royals certainly seem to have the edge right now. They Bobby Witt is among the best players in baseball. Pasquantino has 4 home runs. MJ Melendez, I believe, has four or five home runs. And then you've got the old pain in the neck, Salvador Perez, having a monster season right now.
The grizzled veteran.
348 with 6 home runs already. He's got a 184 WRC plus as a catcher. Just, boy, he's been a thorn in Detroit's side for a decade plus now. Like,
yeah.
I keep waiting for him to retire, but he's only, let's see, he's probably still younger than I expect. He's only 33. He doesn't turn 34 until another 2 weeks. 252 career home runs from a catcher, career 270 hitter. Just a darn good player.
He's just evolved into such a good hitter, even from when he started. You know, back when he was younger, he was almost like, you know, extra base hitter, nothing.
From
him, you know, and he's become much more than that now. Just an impressive guy. I don't know what else to say. I mean, one thing I will say is this. Got to give Royals the credit in one respect. They hung on to him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were a lot of Royals writers and fans and stuff who said, hey, we're rebuilding. They should move you, Salvi. As much as they loved him, they wanted to move him and get something. They didn't. They hung on to him. They signed him. And here they are kind of on the way up, and he's leading the charge.
Yeah, and, you know, it always felt like he was almost like a Javi Baez level of free swinger.
Yeah.
Where you could throw him anything outside of the zone and he would swing at it. But also, if you threw anything in the zone, he could hit it. Like, that was always, seemed like, I can't remember how many times it was like, you know, Verlander would leave a pitch in the zone somewhere. It wasn't a bad pitch, and Perez would knock it out of the park. So,
well, that's where Spencer Torkelson should watch him this week.
Yeah.
Because,
is that a bad point?
Yeah, because Salvador Perez, as you mentioned, when it's in the zone, he covers the whole zone. I mean, he can go get that outside pitch and he can drive it somewhere, you know, and as you mentioned, that's not what we're seeing from Spencer.
Yeah. No, he may just not have that level of barrel control. I don't know, but
yeah,
I don't know. I mean, we talk about that and all that negative stuff, but we can also talk about Kerry Carpenter continuing to be a good player too, if we want.
Sure.
I mean, there's positives.
There definitely are. You know, I was just coming up about the Royals too. I think their ERA, I don't know what, today they won 2-1 in five innings, so I'm sure it went down. But I saw their ERA as a team is 3.16. So they're really, you know, the young pitcher, the young hitters are doing well for them, but boy, they're pitching the baseball pretty well. Seth Lugo and Cole Reagans, and they found a closer perhaps in this Mr. MacArthur. They're calling him the general. And, you know, I think I predicted them. I don't know what I predicted. I can't remember anymore. About 70 wins, though. But, you know, again, it's only April. The Pirates started 18-8 last year, and that fizzled. But the Royal, I mean, it seems like they have a ball club that in this division, unless, you know, assuming the Guardians don't stay on this insane pace, I think they can be in it, at least through this parts of the summer.
Yeah, I am. And, you know, the Tigers are facing, they get kind of fortunate that they're not facing Reagans.
Right.
Although, you know, I think they got to him last year a couple times. It seemed like he would shut them down and then they would, you know, get to the bullpen immediately after. But they, you know, he pitched today, so they don't get him. But they're getting Seth Lugo and Brady Singer and Michael Wacha. And that's three kind of solid veteran pitchers who it wouldn't shock me if they shut the offense down a little bit. But you hope the Tigers can, you know, have a good approach and string together some hits and maybe get some more power showing. Yeah.
Well, you know, all of those guys are capable of going out and giving you six innings and allowing two runs, right? I mean, yeah. And you wouldn't even be the least bit stunned by any of that. So, yeah, there's really not a weak arm at this point in that rotation.
Yeah. You know, I'm checking the forecast here. Tomorrow looks like it's going to be pleasant in the, you know, 60s, low 60s, 50s at game time. Saturday, Saturday and Sunday, there's rain in the forecast, but the temps are back up into the 70s. So, depending on when that rain comes, I don't know. We could end up with another doubleheader with Matt Manning starting on one of those days. But otherwise, maybe with a little bit warmer temperatures, maybe some more baseballs are going to fly out of the yard.
So the Tigers, they have who's pitching tomorrow?
Let's see who is. Let me check one more time. I was just cycling through looking at the opponents. Tomorrow is Reese Olson.
Okay.
Saturday is Casey Mize, and Sunday is Tarik Skubal. So you like the Tigers odds here too, I would think.
Yeah. If you want to call this a big division showdown, which might be a little early to say that, but you know, if you want to, this is what they would want lined up, I would think. So it should be a fun weekend. I'm looking forward to the series. I hope the rain doesn't play too much havoc with it.
Yeah, I agree. And I know the draft will still be going on down there on Friday and Saturday. So things are going to get, you know, like a big airplane hangar down full of drunken football fans.
Well, they better have something fun beside, you know, I could see going for the first round of the draft, and I could even see going on a Friday night for the second and third round. But boy, if I'm there watching the sixth round of the NFL draft, they better have something else good going on too.
I'm sure they have, you know, you can, you know, time yourself in the 40-yard dash and try to kick field goals and stuff. But yeah, I agree with you. You know, you're not going to be sitting there. There are hardcore football fans that are sitting there and analyzing every pick all the way to Mr. Irrelevant. Is this guy the new Brock Purdy? I do that with the baseball draft, and that's much less followed than football. But, you know, when you're a baseball nerd, you're a baseball nerd.
My NFL draft story is, I was in like seventh, maybe sixth or seventh, probably seventh grade. And I was legitimately sick one day. Mm-hmm. And the NFL draft back then was on Tuesdays.
Oh, wow.
And I was home and I flipped on ESPN. And this was like the second year ever that they televised the draft. I had no idea it was on. But it was like 8 a.m. I watched that thing the whole day because I was feeling like crap and I was laying on the couch. And I loved every second of it as a teenage kid, man. This was incredible. So lo and behold, I suddenly had the sniffles every year throughout my high school career on NFL draft day. Imagine that. So that became my little tradition. I was always home watching the draft, and I've kind of grown out of that over the years. I don't watch the whole thing anymore, but that was my fun thing as a kid.
That's fun. Yeah. You know, I grew up, we didn't have cable when I was growing up in Ypsilanti, Michigan. Take a drink. Except there were occasions when my brother would go up, he'd climb up on the telephone pole and steal cable for us for a couple months until the cable company came and put the blockers back on. That's how you used to be able to do it. They just had little scramblers.
Yeah.
You could unscrew them and then you got cable. but then I became friends with some kids in my neighborhood, and there were three boys, two twins who were a year older than me, and their older brother who was like 2-3 years older than me. And their dad was the sports information director at Eastern Michigan. And they were just gigantic sports fans. Just, you know, I played baseball and soccer, but I didn't, you know much about anything else. And I started hanging out with them a bunch. And I remember going over one day, and I didn't even know, I don't think I knew what the NFL draft existed. I didn't know anything about the NFL really. And yeah, we sat there and watched. And I'm like, huh, this is fascinating. Yeah. And the oldest boy had a legal pad and was writing down every team who they picked. Yeah, writing down every pick. I was like, what? You know, it's funny to think about that now because, yeah, no internet back then. Although I think Prodigy had just started the online thing.
Sure.
But yeah, you'd have to wait for the paper to come out, or maybe that wouldn't even happen. You wouldn't know who took who. So.
Oh, one time I went on a golf trip with a couple buddies of mine. We were down in Mount Pleasant. We played the Polecat, if anybody's been there. And all of a sudden, I didn't even know my friend Jeff was a draft fanatic. He goes, "We gotta get to the hotel." I'm like, what are you talking about? Draft's on. I'm like, are you kidding me? We're going out. He goes, no, we're gonna watch the draft. So all of a sudden, he's got a 12-pack of beer and a couple pizzas, and we're sitting in we're supposed to be out on the town, and we're sitting in a Comfort Inn in Mount Pleasant watching the draft. You gotta be kidding me. But that the draft has a lot of power over a lot of people. There's no question.
Yeah, and you know what's funny is, I believe the story is that, you know, ESPN couldn't get anything good back in the early 80s or whatever, and nobody thought that, I don't think any of the, like, ABC, NBC, CBS, I don't think they thought anybody would care about the draft, so
yeah.
ESPN was like, we'll take it, we'll broadcast it, and it ended up being huge for them.
Sure. If you were around then, when I was a kid home on the couch, those broadcasts were incredibly rudimentary.
Mm-hmm.
They would have, and I'm not even making this up, Mel Kiper, very, very young Mel Kiper, was sitting in the hallway of some hotel, outside some team's draft room, and he had this little card table with this little thing that said his name on it, this little blanket, basically. That said Mel Kiper draft expert or something, whatever it said. Yeah. And it was just
football a joke. C-span.
And they were just, they were sitting at these, desks with no graphics, no nothing, just guys talking about football. But it was awesome. And I can see how people have gravitated toward it.
Yeah. In the parallel, of course, is the MLB draft, which you couldn't find information on that anywhere. Like you listen to podcasts and the old timers at Baseball America had to like call up Major League Baseball and have them tell them the picks.
Yeah.
It was not. And really, I mean, the first TV broadcast was 2009, 2020 or 2010. It was the Mike Trout.
Yeah. Mike Trout
draft. Mm-hmm. And he famously was the only one who showed up because he lives in New Jersey. And it was, I think the studios are in Secaucus or whatever.
Yeah.
And they've done a much better job of televising that and making that more of an event. It's still somewhat niche. It'll never be the way football is. But we did our draft show last year and it was pretty fun. And I think people are getting into that.
Go ahead.
You go ahead.
Okay. this would be around 2005, right? Mm-hmm. And I had the best job I ever had or ever will have. I was working for a college up in Minnesota. We had a suburban campus in the suburb I lived in. I was the only full-time employee in the building, which means nobody knew what the hell I was doing. And I loved every second of it. As long as the doors were open and the teachers had their rooms set and I talked to whoever showed up to talk about the school, they didn't care what I did. So I was listening to the first time that they had ever put under over MLB.com, the MLB draft. And it was all done over the phone.
Yeah.
They were just, they would just come on. It was basically a group call. You'd come on over the speakerphone and say you're drafting so-and-so from blankety blank high school. And all of a sudden, once in a while, someone, you'd hear Tommy Lasorda's voice come on because the Dodgers had him doing a pick or, or Brooks Robinson came on for the Orioles, and why they even bothered having celebrities to this phone call was beyond me. But it was the best word for that was rudimentary as well. And what they're trying to grow it into now is a different animal.
Yeah, I mean, you still hear that. That's the way they do day two and day three of the MLB draft is they basically just play that conference call where, you know, California selects player ID 41799B, McGonagall, Kevin. It's you get real nerdy if you're like me and you look it up and go, oh, I know that guy. I've never heard of that guy. And as Tyler Madison says here, says, my dad has told me in the old days, you'd just see the lineup on opening day or maybe watch it on TV. And that was the quote prospect scene, unless you lived in a minor league city. And I think Rogelio has talked before about, you know, Lynn Henning used to write articles about the minor leagues and the news for a long, long time. But I don't know if there was much coverage beyond that. When I was a young kid, basically the only prospects I knew about were the ones who got baseball cards. You know, they'd be rated rookies or, Rico Bronya was a top prospect for the Tigers. And you go, all right, I guess. Yeah, no idea.
I remember Juan Encarnacion, right, was getting a lot of buzz. But you never heard of him until the spring training where he finally made the club. Well, it turned out he'd been in the program for a long time, you know. But all of a sudden, Juan Encarnacion, out of nowhere, they dropped this guy who was going to be a man. They were touting him as the next Clemente for a while there.
He was an awfully big, you know. That was the Randy Smith, you know, Encarnacion, Infante, Santiago, all those guys were, I think, you know, going to be the cornerstone of the next playoff contender. And it didn't work out. But that's what, I mean, we've seen that in the last 5-6 years about building around prospects. It can work out some, but usually it never works out exactly the way you want it to. I said, you know, we weren't really going to do segments here, but if I will throw up what my good would have been.
Sure.
And it was going to be Riley Green and Tarek Skubal, because we talked a bunch over the offseason and, you know, in the early part of the season about what a Tigers playoff contender would look like. And there are a whole bunch of different things that could happen. But we, I think, kind of universally agreed that what had to happen for the Tigers to do that was for Tarek Skubal to pitch like a Cy Young candidate and Riley Green to hit like a potential MVP. And hey, so far, so good. So far, so good.
No question.
Skubal's top 10 in F-War. Green is top 10 in B-War. Take the one, whatever one's better. That's my policy.
Exactly.
But they're both, I mean, we talked about Skubal looking dominant. Green still, his average is still not up, but you take the 390 on base percentage and those, you know, hitting moonshot bombs.
No doubt.
You just keep him healthy. He's 6 defensive runs above saved. He's on pace for a 4 or 5 win season, which is exactly what you need. So that is good.
No, that makes total sense to me. I mean, the studs have to tow the ship, right? They have to bring this team along. Riley Green playing like a star and being available, which I like seeing him. I think he DH'd 2 games in a row recently, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's great. You know, I think Hinch playing the long game, keeping him healthy, means so much to where they want to go. They need him to be a star, and they need him to be an available star. Skubal, same thing, has that long injury sheet, but boy, he doesn't look like it right now. I mean, that was Cy Young level stuff we saw on Monday night. You know, I'll put that against anybody's stuff, really. If he can continue that and stay healthy, you know, that's the anchor that the rotation needs. And, you know, Casey Mize is on the way. I'm not saying he's going to be as good as Skubal this year, but I think he's going to pitch pretty well. I mean, that fastball is starting to look legit. Now you got 2 starters to build around. Riley Green, offensively, they're going to need some more help. I mean, someone else is going to have to turn this on. Now, Mark Canna is playing well. Mm-hmm. He's a 34-year-old on a 1-year deal. And again, still April. So he's playing extremely well, but he's probably playing above some of the numbers we've seen him produce the last couple of years. So if he can help carry this team into May, it's going to be hopefully then somebody else is going to have to start hitting the ball extremely well to back these guys up. And obviously that would be Torkelson and Colt Keith are the two that pop to mind. And of course, Carpenter.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's still like, I'd like to say that I'm fully bought in on Kerry Carpenter. I am for the most part. You still have just a tiny bit of like, I don't know if he really is, you know, this true, like number four, number five hitter. But he certainly has performed like that to the first 170, 175 games of his career. So I'm not going to down him, but yeah, I mean, that looks like a really good second piece. And with Canna, yeah, I mean, I agree with you. It seems like, I think his career high in home runs is 26. I was just looking it up. And that was 2019 when everybody hit 26 home runs, except for the Tigers. other than that, his career high is 17. So he's got five right now, you know, on pace for 20 plus, which would be awesome. Unexpected, that's for sure. Tyler asks, he says, do you guys think Mark Canna would be brought back if he can keep up somewhat close to his current pace?
Oh, current pace, 100%.
Yeah, you know, it wouldn't shock me at all. But I also, you know, you mentioned his age, and Scott Harris doesn't strike me as the sort of guy who would give a 34, 35, 36-year-old a multi-year deal. Now, maybe Canna's an exception because, you know, he's such a disciplined, solid hitter. But I would think that maybe he could get a multi-year deal, a two-year deal from someone. I don't know. Maybe they'd give him a 2-year deal with an option of some sort. I wouldn't hate it, but you do wonder. We talk a little bit about the outfield situation. I don't know. It would have to depend on how Meadows plays and how Vadu and Malloy and Bigby are looking, if they all seem like they can contribute or not.
Right. Yeah. Put it this way: if they offered him a 1-year extension for next year, if they did that right now, I wouldn't even bat an eye. I mean, whatever, that's fine. But now you get into 2 and 3 years. That's asking a lot for a dude who's, you know, going to eventually here enter the second half of his 30s. I'd be interested to know more about some of the analytics. You know, if they're measuring bat speed and all that kind of thing, what does his look like compared to past years? And is there any degradation? And maybe they don't see any. That would definitely, I think, would influence something. Whether they want to take a chance on keeping an older guy around. But otherwise, I think the deal they signed him on this year was perfect. 1 year, see how it goes. You know, next year, we'll see how it goes.
Yeah. No, I would not be against it at all. Multiple year, 2 years, Harris-type deal he gave out in San Francisco. It says Javi Baez, El Mago. Yeah, I mean, that's it wouldn't necessarily shock me. And, you know, you would hope, I don't know, it also feels a little bit like the Jonathan Scope situation with the last, you know, front office where, you know, he came and he performed pretty well. They signed him to an extension and then immediately fell off the cliff. Now, completely different hitters, but.
Undisciplined, you know, versus discipline. Yeah.
Yeah. You do have to, as you said, you gotta trust your underlying data that we don't have access to.
Yeah. Well, and Scope, we've talked about this back in the day. I was dead set against signing him for more years. His whole thing was built on that 6-week heater that he had, which was an all timer and it was fun to watch. And I hate to, you know, criticize the guy because that was 6 of the best weeks of hitting you'll ever see. But it was totally unsustainable and nothing he'd ever done before. And he certainly never did it again, but he made a lot of money out of it. So they have to be careful of that. But here's the thing. There's no rush about bringing back Mark Canna. I mean, we can have this same conversation in June and July. And if they want to sign him, he's still hitting and they want to sign him. He's, you know, he's at that age where he's probably very signable. Even then, he'd be amenable to it, I bet.
Yeah, I would think so. You could maybe some kind of incentive-laden deal. You know, you get 600 plate appearances and, a second year kicks in or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm sure they're thinking about it in some capacity, but maybe not too hard right now. Because, yeah, as you said, it's still April. One thing, you know, we've pretty much discussed everything that's going on in the field. We haven't really, it is, you know, NFL draft night. So I was wondering if we wanted to dig into the Major League Baseball draft at all. We haven't really discussed that a ton. The Tigers have the 11th pick. Baseball America just expanded their board to 400. MLB Pipeline just expanded theirs to 150 and reordered it. I was wondering if you have any particular thoughts right now with the draft still about 2.5 months away.
Well, it'd be a nice year to be in the top two and get Charlie Conlon or Jack Caglione. I'll tell you that. But they're not going to, and that's fine. I've been struck. I've been trying to follow. I've been digging into. It looks like there's a lot of catchers this year who have a somewhere in the first round grade, right? That dude out of California, Caleb Lomavita.
Yep.
They're saying that he might be the most offensively advanced of the bunch, perhaps. So that's a guy I want to keep my eyes on for the rest of the college year. And if that's a player, you know, there'd be nothing wrong with adding a first-rate catcher to the organization.
Yeah. Now the Lomavita, the one question I have, he seems to be kind of an aggressive hitter, which doesn't seem to fit Scott Harris mold. Yeah. But catching is so hard to find. And outside of Dingler right now, who looks like a backup, there's not a whole lot in the system. They could certainly use an infusion of catching talent. There is the guy from Sam Houston seems to be rising up boards really fast. What's his name? I'm looking. It is Walter Janik. Kind of went from he's having a really good year, but you know, it's Sam Houston, so you know. It's interesting. Right now, you'll hear people talk about it's basically a top eight of college players.
Yeah,
that are all kind of bundled in the same group. I do think there is a smaller group of like the top three or four with Charlie Condon and Travis Bazana of Oregon State. You mentioned Jack Caglione from Florida. Some people still like Nick Kurtz from Wake Forest, but then there's like Chase Burns, the right-handed pitcher who's got electric stuff, but kind of looks like a reliever to me. And then Hagen Smith. Yeah. The lefty from Arkansas who's got 100 strikeouts, I think faster than anybody in history or something like that. I think we mentioned it, like just about everybody who's out there was projected to have a good season is having a good season. Braden Montgomery was a two-way player. He was at Stanford, and I think he transferred to Texas A&M, and he's having an awesome year as a hitter. Don't think he's pitching anymore. But yeah, it feels a little bit like I said, there's a top eight. J.J. Weatherholt was a guy who was ranked as one of the top two or three bats heading into the season, but he's had trouble staying healthy for like the last year and a half. So you could potentially see him falling to the Tigers at 11. It would be, if he fell, it would probably be for health reasons, and that would be a little bit risky, but
I don't mind taking a risk on talent. I mean, if they really believe in if they believe in the bat, they believe in the talent, you know, hopefully he's had a spate of injuries. Maybe that's something that you can shake, you know, grow past and mature through, you know? So that if that happens, you know, depending on who else goes where, that wouldn't seem like a terrible idea. One thing that does seem like it's a shortage of this year, whereas there might be a fair amount of catchers, no shortstops.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, and you know, I've been hoping the Tigers would draft a shortstop really high for a long time. And, it doesn't look like this might be the year to do it either.
Yeah. So as Stando said here, I looked at this year's MLB mock drafts and there doesn't seem to be many prep players. Is this traditionally the way it is? And the answer to that is no. This is actually, it could be historically low number of high school players taken in the first round. And that goes kind of to Yoop's point. Usually there are those high school shortstops, high school pitching has been a little bit, yeah, you know, teams are avoiding that now, and that was going to be my ugly today because I was looking back at the 2018 draft. But yeah, it's just a really, you know, there's a decent amount of high school talent kind of in that second, third round range. But yeah, the top of the board is dominated by college position players and a couple pitchers. There are two exceptions right now, at least. One of them is Connor Griffin, who kind of came into the year as the top high school player. He's just a really terrific athlete. He plays shortstop right now. Some people think he can play shortstop in pro ball, although other people think you'd be best to put him in center field and let him go out and be a, you know, plus athlete. But he's putting up, you know, bonkers stats in high school. Whatever you want to say about high school, he's got like 65 steals or something like that. And the other one is Bryce Rayner, who is a shortstop from Harvard Westlake. Now there's some concern that he might outgrow the position because he's 6'3". It's kind of that you know, you get comparisons to Corey Seager or Colson Montgomery.
Power bat.
A left-handed hitter, really good. He was also a pitcher, you know, up into the mid-90s. So he's got a strong arm, good athlete, lots of power. some field to hit. Yeah, he's a guy that I don't think the Tigers would hesitate to take at 11. I just wonder if he'll even be there, because I do think, as you said, you know, you go for the talent, and there's going to be a team, I think, in the top 10 who's just going to go after the prep guys because they like it more.
And I think Baseball America had Rainier with the Tigers on number 11 this week. And I love the point that it went at the National High School Invitational, where, you know, the elite guys are, he had the five hardest hit balls of the tournament, you know? So there's definitely some pop in the bat. So whether he can stay at shortstop, who knows? If he's a third baseman, that's fine. You know, if the bat plays, they will find a spot.
Yeah. And I mean, it was supposedly a relatively down NHSI in terms of overall draft talent, but he was the top ranked prospect there and went up there and performed. And, you know, those are real games. That's some of the best teams in the country coming together to play real games. It's not, you know, showcase hitting, you know, home run derby home runs. And that's kind of, you know, PJ Morlando was one of the top high school hitters heading into this year's class. And he's falling down boards, at least according to Baseball America and MLB Pipeline, because there's some questions about how much of that hit and power is real and how much of it is just kind of putting on displays and batting practice and home run derbies. So, yeah, it's the Deadly Ninja Beast said we're definitely taking high schooler, right? And that seems to be Mark Connor's jam, right? We talked about that. He took a bunch of high schoolers in San Diego. The Tigers went high schooler with three of their top four picks last year, and actually four of their top five, and then added more later in the draft. Which I like. You know, if we Kevin McGonigal just came back to Lakeland and it was an immediate laser show. He his first batted ball of the season was a 103 mile an hour line drive that the second baseman snagged. I saw it was a 940 expected batting average. It was like, oh, well, that's a tough one. But then he started off yesterday's game 3-for-3 with a double, and he just looks like he can hit. And Max Clark is certainly figuring some things out. You know, he didn't do much today, but yesterday had a big RBI triple. And I think that the MLB Pipeline tweeted out that he made it to third in 11.5 seconds, which was faster than all but seven big leaguers this year.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. I saw that tweet too. That was fun. You know what I like about the kid? And this means nothing. Well, I mean, it depends how much you like the intangibles, right? What kind of grade you put on that. That kid looks like he's having fun.
Yeah.
Every time you see him, whether it's an interview or just sitting in the stands or out on the field, man, he looks like he's having a great time. So I hope he makes it just for that. He's going to be a real breath of fresh air if he maintains that kind of an attitude as he gets into the big leagues.
Yeah, and it's fun having that top three right now of McGonigal, Clark, and Briseño. You know, Briseño hit a bit of a cold stretch, but he did hit a big RBI double today. So yeah, I don't know. We still haven't seen much from the rest of the high schoolers from last year's draft. I'm sure we will. The complex league starts May 4th, I believe, which is So we're going to see Carson Rucker soon, and I mean we won't see them because it's complex league, but right. Yeah. We'll see their stats soon. And Carson Rucker and Paul Wilson, Jenk Diaz if he's healthy, and Andrew Dunford and Blake Dickerson. All these young, exciting players. And I think the system needs it. There's a little bit of a gap there in talent in high West Michigan and Erie right now. Erie is struggling to score because they just don't have a ton of big bats.
Right.
And one of the things we did, I put up yesterday Ty Madden's most recent start and Jaden Hamm's most recent start. And they were both pretty darn good. Ty Madden, five scoreless, seven strikeouts, and Hamm gave up one. He gave up a two-run homer to Alex Mooney, local Orchard Lake St. Mary's kid, which is kind of, you know, cool. You don't want Hamm to give up home runs, but they both look like they're ready to move up in the world, just like Rogelio is moving up from the land of 10,000 lakes.
There Minnesota. You go.
How are we doing up there, Raj?
Man, the legend.
It's been pretty good. I mean, I won $100 playing Russian roulette Wow. The roulette table here in beautiful Mystic Lake Casino where my work conference is. And so, yeah, I was able to watch baseball. I watched a little bit. I've been watching Tigers games on replay and what have you. So it's been fun. But I'm socially burnt out. I'm over it. Like, I've been engaged with people. I sent Chris earlier this presentation. We did like a Shark Tank presentation. And I've done 3 hours worth of presentation. So but I wanted to jump on because there's some plenty of things to talk about.
Yeah. I mean, we discussed some of the games. We talked about the NFL draft. I kind of diverted the conversation into the baseball draft. but if there's you've been out and about, I know you went to that, I thought you were going to get to see a White Sox win, but they managed to blow it.
It was, you know what, Target Field, if anybody has not been to Target Field yet, I highly suggest checking it out. It's a very, very cool facility. One of the better stadiums I've been to. Been to now 6 major league stadiums, and that's probably been so far my best. My best experience so far. Keep in mind, there was no crowd there because the Timberwolves were playing next door against the Suns, and that was packed. Yes, Stan, by the way, Stan wants to know if Mystic Lake still have the searchlights lit form in a former TP. Yes, it do. And that's really cool. I sent a video to Chris. Did I send you that TP video, Chris?
A TP video? I don't know.
Or the lights form is like a TP?
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you did or not. I'm looking.
Yeah. Like they have a nice golf course.
Oh, yeah. That's where we were, the conference part of it, where we saw the golf course quite a bit. But Target Field, I will say this. It was – Minnesota Twins fans are some of the most knowledgeable baseball fans I've ever met. Like they observe the rules too of like going back to your seat when there's no like. I've talked about this with Chris many times. When I go to Mudhead games, or a lot of minor league games, or even Tiger games, certain fans will wait until the play's over, then go down their seat. Minor league stadiums don't. I mean, no offense to anybody who goes to Mudhead games, but there's people literally get up in the middle of a play. Why? I don't know. But Twins fans, they wait. They'll patiently wait. And there was a lot of people who had the radio, like the old school radio on, listening to the game. And they're just random people who are just like friendly talking to you. You just sit there in line, all of a sudden they start talking about something. And you're just like, I was taken aback a couple times because I was with a group and like, oh yeah, it's common. People just talk to you randomly. So
sure.
Target Field is a great, great facility.
I've been there many times now, a good dozen times. It's on the smallest footprint of land of any stadium in MLB.
Yeah.
And you can tell that. The upper decks are pretty steep and they're close to the action. So even if you're sitting upstairs, you got a heck of a view. And I love those limestone walls too.
I was just going to say, I sat in section 102 right against the right field wall right there.
Oh,
and
cool.
It was enjoyable. So, but speaking of enjoyable, there was one. Have you guys done the segments yet, or we
I did. I prepared. I don't know if you prepared one. I can do them if you want. You said he can.
No. I was just gonna say there was the only we haven't. I technically didn't prepare. I mean, I did prepare an inside number, but I was just kind of curious. If you guys did the segments or not? Normally, this show is kind of like not our. Everybody's been off, so.
I have the stuff prepared. If we want to go, and then that maybe gives you a chance to put something together if you want. I can
go first. Let's go inside the numbers. What is your inside number this week?
So I picked two. It is 55 and 21. And those numbers represent the number of hard hit balls, 95 miles an hour plus, in barrels from Shohei Ohtani this year. Both first in baseball by significant margin. The next closest in hard hits is Juan Soto at 48. And this is before tonight, so I haven't updated it. So 7 behind. And Soto and Witt are tied for second in barrels at 15, so 6 barrels behind Ohtani. Now, he has played a few more games because he was in the Soul thing, but still, it's 27 games. He's on pace for 126 barrels this year. And the most that StatCast has, since StatCast started, was 106 by Aaron Judge in 2022. And the second most was Aaron Judge with 87 in 2017. So could be looking, obviously he has to keep this pace up, which is not guaranteed, but could be looking at a historic slugging season from Shohei Ohtani, who doesn't seem the slightest bit bothered by the, you know, massive interpreter betting scandal around him. Even if he's involved in it or not, doesn't seem to bother him at all, which is crazy.
I'm telling you, it's just like he, it's almost like he's robotic. And like, you know, like just want to, I don't know. It's so weird. You got an inside number you want to go over?
Oh, you know, I was just,
if not, I can go. I have one. So I was looking at the article on, we talked about a little bit last year. The article I was reading this morning was about Jordan Walker going back down to Memphis. And this is a guy who last year, after starting off the 12-game hitting streak to start his career, got sent down, and you thought, like, with all the trades and everything, he would get his playing time, but he's off to a really rough start. The number is 232. That's him. That's his line drive rate, or in terms of line drives, where he ranks in line drives. But the reason why that number is only important is because Parker Meadows still hasn't had a line drive hit this season. So Parker Meadows, for all, I mean, numbers are encouraging, what have you, but 232, I mean, that's what Jordan Walker ranks. Parker Meadows is not even ranked at this moment. So that's how brutal it is, that adjustment from AAA to the major leagues is.
Well, you know, we talked about it a little bit before you got here, but why don't you give us your opinion? How, even if the team continues to have some success in the win column, how long do you stick with Parker Meadows at this current pace?
Really, you write it out until probably beginning of June, because I don't think the Tigers really have a solution right now. I mean, if you look down at AAA and AA right now, there's no viable solution. Who's going to replace Parker Meadows? Unless you get some really clever. I know Ibañez started his rehab assignment tonight. So are the days over for Zach McKinstry? Who knows? But, I mean, are you going to really put Wenzel Perez in center field over Parker Meadows? You're losing an elite defender for a hitter. You're going bat first there. That doesn't fit into what the Tigers' philosophy is going to be. So, but if you look at the current outfield situation across the board right now in the minor leagues, Justin, like somebody was saying, I've seen this before on Twitter. You know, Dylan Ingeby suggested something like having Matt Burling out there, but it's not a bad idea either. But I don't think you lose something else. If you're going to call up Justin Hammer Malloy, I don't think Malloy is going to be a much better solution right now, at this point right now. No. But I give him till the beginning. I give him till the beginning of June. Because by the next couple of weeks, the weather's going to be warming up. But, yeah, it's the same thing with Cole Keith. When people talk about, I think maybe you should just put him on the bench more when Ibañez comes back. But as Hinch indicated earlier in the week, he doesn't see himself calling on Cole Keith.
Yeah, you know, the second best center fielder option is Riley Green. And I really think they don't want to do that. He's not playing any less aggressively in left field, but he's playing so well out there that it's hard to move him. You would have to move Green to center. Like Vierling can do it in a pinch. Perez can theoretically do it in a pinch. Badu can, but none of those guys are going to be nearly as good as Meadows, and really probably not nearly as good as Green. So that's a good point. And for people who are wondering and maybe didn't see it, Ibañez did go 2-for-3 in Toledo today with a double.
There you go. I mean, go ahead, Eber.
Well, I was saying, a lot of these problems go away if Parker Meadows can just hit 245 for 3 weeks.
Yeah, that's true.
Everybody be like, oh, okay, now we're good. Yeah. The bar is low for him. That's the cool thing. You know, he doesn't need to hit 290 with a whole ton of power, right? You know, just 240, 245, a little bit of power, play your defense, and all these conversations around him go away.
Yeah, no, I agree. You're right. I mean, he's still almost, an average, or, you know, negative or zero war, despite, you know, having done almost nothing in the batter's box. So just a little bit, you know, bet 200.
Probably fine.
Yeah.
I do like what Tyler said here. He says he's in a personal opinion. As long as Meadows' war is positive, he's worth keeping no matter his batting. And I would agree. I mean, he does cover a lot of ground in center field. He runs really quick, especially at. You know what's interesting too is Comerica Park, the Tigers are a sub five, like the Tigers are better on the road than they are at home. But Meadows still does the job no matter where he plays at. It doesn't matter the outfield situation. But I was thinking about Badu as a possible replacement. I was looking at some of his numbers. Some of the exit velocity is cool, but he's better as a corner outfielder than he is in center field. Because some of the routes he's taking in center field, watching Toledo, Chris, I mean, you remember a couple games saw live where it was just like,
yeah. Yeah, he just doesn't seem comfortable in center field. Yeah, I mean, that's what you're looking at. You'd probably, like I said, you'd have to move Green to center and then make Badu a corner outfielder or fourth outfielder or something like that. You'd be looking at Green in center and Vierling, Carpenter, and Canna in the corners. And that's, I mean, Green and Meadows have combined for like 12 defensive run saves so far this year. So it's, you know, you're helping out the entire team when you do that. So I don't know. I think your point is good, Roger. I think maybe early June, if it's still this ugly, then I think, yeah, they figure something out. Maybe Max Clark is ready.
I love it. No, that's where, I mean, here's the thing, too. This is where I love to see Scott Harris's merit right here. And by the way, Deadly Ninja B says Meadows hitting seventh in the order is ridiculous. If you think about Jake Rogers struggling at the plate, is it really that much too far fetched for him having Meadows at seventh?
I think so. Yeah, I think batting order stuff is generally kind of overrated after. And as long as they've got like the four or five best hitters batting in the top five, after that, you just kind of, it's AJ Hinch doing left, right, left stuff to force the other manager's hand into, you know, not bringing in relievers or bringing in relievers.
Yeah. Here's where Scott Harris, this is where I'm going to be seeing, I'd like to see what Scott Harris is going to do here. Do you just stay the course? And if the Tigers are contending, right, if the Tigers are, say, hovering around the division lead in like late June, early July, do you make a move to address Parker Meadows struggling? Do you know what I mean? Like, there's just, this is where it'll be interesting. I think this is where the Tigers pitching and what I mean, there was somebody yesterday who was complaining, Great White, who never seems to be happy with anything on Twitter, was just like, "Oh, I'll just see the stats from a month from now." The Tigers have a bullpen that is going to be, I think it's going to be consistently among the top five in the American League.
Yeah.
Do I think they have enough pitching to beat the likes of Baltimore? Baltimore. Didn't they just call up Kristen or
Heston Kerstad?
Heston Kerstad, yep. Yep.
Yeah, Kerstad. Yeah.
And they still have Mayo. And your guy Couser hit another home run the other night. You know, I don't know. He's crazy, man. He looks like the early favorite for Rookie of the Year, and it's like, okay, well, they definitely need more good young hitters. yeah, I don't know what they're doing over there. I would like a little bit of that, but yeah, I mean, they look dangerous. You just wonder, you know, Tigers been pitching well. You mentioned that the bullpen, you know, Will Vest had a rough outing the other day, but that's going to happen with relievers. You know, the rest of that bullpen. Shelby Miller has given up a couple home runs, I think, or at least, you know, he's given up one and he's had a couple rough outings. But, you know, Chafin's been great. Holton's been great. Foley's been great. Lang has been serviceable lately.
I was going to say this. Lang looks, he gives me these little moments of hope now. You know, he's around the plate. He's having a dalliance with home plate that is lasting for now.
Yeah. So, yeah. Go ahead, Brad. No, you go ahead.
I was going to ask you if you guys talked about the Royals coming into town yet.
Yeah, we touched on that. We touched on their rotation. It's going to be Lugo, Singer, Waka. We talked about how their offense is going. We talked about Salvador Perez being an annoying old guy who's not even that old.
Perez just feel like he's been in the league since 2005. I don't know why I feel like that way, but I feel like he's been around forever.
Yeah.
That's all I got to add.
His evolution as a hitter has been really something to watch.
Now, the million-dollar question for you guys is, are the Royals legit or not?
You know, I don't know. That's not a good answer. I don't think they're this good, but there's, as we talked about it earlier, that their young hitters are doing well this year. They're outpacing the Tigers' young hitters. You know, Witt is off to a great start. Melendez, Michael Garcia, Pasquantino, they're all playing well. Whereas the Tigers have basically Green and Carpenter playing well. You know, we haven't seen Keith or Torkelson or Meadows step up yet. So I think the, you know, Canna and Perez maybe offset a little bit as the vet in the lineup. And then it's just a matter of whose rotation is better. And it's really kind of similar, right? I think that you might have a little bit more upside in Olsen and Mize than they have in, you know, Waka, Lugo, Singer.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, Reagan's is pretty darn good. I don't know if he's quite to Scooble's level, but he has that level of talent. So I don't know. If we think the Tigers can win 85 games plus, I don't think there's any reason that the Royals can't now.
At one point recently, they were leading the league in run differential. You know, I don't know where it is now. I haven't looked. But they don't strike me as that good, okay? A team that's going to lead the AL in run differential. So you have to think they're going to come back to the pack a little. And we'll see how they weather that when they do. But, you know, they signed some reliable veteran pitching. And guys who, you know, should be able to get them through the summer. So if the young guys keep hitting, you know, they're a decent team. And Bobby Witt is probably one of the four or five best players in baseball.
And I do think, you know, and I'm not intimately familiar with the Royals farm system, but I know it's not very good. And I know that if their depth gets challenged, I think the Tigers are in a better position right now to, you know, as we said, Matt Manning is still just cooling his heels in Toledo. And the Royals, they had Alec Marsh come up and he'd been pitching well. And he caught a comebacker, I think, off his arm, and they had to put him on the IL. So they're bringing up Will Klein, I think it is. So yeah, if they get hit by a couple of injuries, they could maybe fall back pretty quickly. But, you know, if they stay healthy, I don't see why they can't continue doing, you know, at least something close to what they've been doing.
Yeah, you know what's interesting, too? Omaha would always have at least one or two bats that stand out. And I don't know, we haven't seen Omaha as of yet down in Toledo. So usually the first baseman, I'm trying to think of the Royals that was hitting, it was hitting really well. And then he just would never, is it Pasquantino?
Yeah.
There's nothing interesting in Omaha right now with that. As far as I know, so we might be seeing the fact that they spent. I just give them a lot of credit for even just spending money this year, and they went out and made their. To me, they had one of the better off seasons in terms of just at least making themselves competitive. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at the White Sox right now, and like going. Okay, let me just tell you this: there was quite a few White Sox fans that actually showed up the other night, and God bless them, because there was a lot of also half Twins, half White Sox jerseys, which apparently is a thing. I'm not sure what's going on with that. Yeah, it was really weird. It was really weird because I didn't expect that in a million years. But there was a few White Sox fans, and yeah, it was interesting to see because I wasn't expecting it whatsoever. But Nick Pratto's down there, but I mean, is he guy? Yeah. Chris? That's.
No, I mean, once upon a time, he was a prospect. He was a first-round pick. He had a big breakout year, I think, the same time Melendez did. But I don't think he's done much with his chances in the big leagues. A lot of strikeouts there, I think, a little too many.
Yep. Fourth overall pick, too, wasn't he? I mean,
Was it that high? That's one of those it's tough taking those high school bets, especially high school first baseman is kind of risky. You have to be really convinced about his ability to hit. Even Adrian Gonzalez, I think, moved a couple times before he really figured it out.
You know, they have a lot of guys like, you know, Asa Lacy didn't make it. I mean, they've had a lot of picks bust, but they've persevered through it.
Yeah.
You know, but they also have a world, they have a World Series at least I can say something about, you know, like.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the strangest, not the strangest, but just an unusual team that was built on defense and relief pitching and putting the ball in play, and it worked. And then all those guys disappeared. Hosmer, Moustakas, Alcides Escobar. Lorenzo Cain was good for a couple more years.
And the weirdest part was the way they were built. When they got into the playoffs, they started hitting for power. Yeah. It wasn't how they were built, but they caught this stretcher. They were smashing the ball.
And yeah. Lacy, by the way, is out for the year. He has that Tommy John surgery, so he's out for the year.
Wow.
I would have my sound effect machine, but I don't have it.
Yeah.
Wah, wah, wah.
You know, I was talking a little bit earlier about my ugly was going to be about the 2018 draft, and honestly, the 2020 draft doesn't look a whole lot better. Like, just it's still a little bit early for both of those drafts, but both of them look kind of cursed right now. Like the drafts that the Tigers had the first overall pick,
brutal.
They're looking rough overall, which is kind of a bummer compared to 2019 and 2021, which looked pretty good. Or 2019 for sure. But
somebody, I think it was Clay Soden, brought up the drafts on Twitter. And I thought it was interesting bringing that up. If there's not been, I'd love to see the Tigers draft history, comparatively speaking, to the Royals around, like, the Royals, at least in the 90s, had like Carlos Beltran. They had a few guys that were at least traded and went elsewhere. So, but that's a decade I would like to compare.
Yeah. We talk about those drafts, Chris. You know, it would be interesting to know a year later if Spencer Torkelson's in the next draft, where does he go? You know, because he was pretty much consensus number one for the Tigers. They didn't screw that up. I mean, everybody kind of was leaning that way. There was nobody else getting a whole lot of buzz. But the next year, probably not.
Yeah, and you just 2021. I don't think so. But yeah, I mean, I think the big thing was COVID really screwed up that year, right? Like they college guys played what 13, 14 games tops. I think high school seasons didn't happen. You know, some people they got the Rangers got Evan Carter because nobody else saw him.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those things where I go back and wonder. At the time, I wanted Austin Martin, and he hasn't turned out great. Nick Gonzalez is kind of bouncing back and forth between AAA and Pittsburgh. Asa Lacy hasn't done anything. Max Meyer was good, then got hurt. He looks like he's coming back, but the Marlins are managing this inning. So I think we talked about it before. The best pick in that draft was Spencer Strider in the fourth round, and he's out with injury now.
He's out. Yeah,
I just think I do wonder how much Torkelson and Martin would have been nitpicked more throughout the next 4 months of the draft process, and if things might have changed. I think was that the year that the Orioles took Kerstad, who we mentioned earlier? I think
because
surprise number two pick.
Yeah,
and that was Rogelio's big splash into the pool. I think that might have been your first big splash.
Yeah, I was totally not expecting that. So Baltimore, for now on, Baltimore does picks. We're not going to say it's big splashes. We just expect them to be in the major leagues in a couple of years.
Yeah.
By the way, did you guys talk about Jackson Jobs?
We didn't.
Performance?
We didn't. He walked. He walked Robert Hassel to lead off the game, and then he retired the next 12 batters.
I was actually watching that during dinner, by the way. Nice. And I'm gonna get out of here. I'm gonna let you guys wrap up the show. But I watched that. I was in a group with a finance group out of Vancouver, and I was social when we were talking, and everybody went and mingled, and I just had the Job. So I had like the Job, my phone against an empty wine glass, and I was sitting there talking, and I'm watching it because I was just like, I was being social, I wasn't being rude, but I just wanted to. If I knew I was going to talk about it tonight, if you guys, it was just masterclass stuff.
Yeah, he you know, it's another cold day. I think it was 45 degrees and windy there in Erie. And so he didn't really early on, didn't seem to have a great feel for his slider, but his changeup comes with him every game. He throws it to lefties. He throws it to righties. It's a good pitch for him. and the fastball was there, and he figured out the command after the first batter, and there you go. Yeah, I mean, he's good. It's, I remember there was, you know, after that outing in spring training, there were people arguing, you know, that he's better than Paul Skeens, and I don't think that's the case. Paul Skeens looks like he's on from another planet when you watch him pitch. It's ridiculous. But yeah, Jackson Jobe, I think, is probably the number two pitching prospect of baseball, and that's nothing to sneeze at. Just keep him healthy.
Exactly. Well, gentlemen, I don't know about you guys, but thanks so much for Uper's glasses need TJ.
Yes, I've managed to break my glasses during the show.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
You get an internal brace in there.
Yeah, the little thing. It's going to need Tommy John surgery. That's all right.
Yep.
I want to catch up on the sports world, so I'm gonna let you guys off.
But we're wrapping it up. We didn't have a whole lot to talk about it left anyway. So thanks everybody for joining us in the kind of an unusual show. Raj, thanks for dropping in. I don't know if we ever got Facebook or Twitter streaming. It's kind of an intimate.
No, we didn't, and that's okay. I mean, I think this is one of those shows that it was a very unusual. It was an unusual format. By the way, Mike's going to be joining us every Sunday now, so Mike's going to be part of the crew going forward. And I do want to want to give a shout out to Cameron. Hopefully everything's going well. Cameron and his family. We haven't had him in a while, and I haven't heard from him in a while, so hopefully everything's well. And I'm looking. Hopefully next week I want to go down the way, or at least go see a couple minor league games next week.
Yeah,
so I don't think they're at home next week, are they? We'll check. Anyway, doesn't matter. Right. But thanks for tuning in, people, everybody.
Yeah. Good to talk to everybody. We'll see you on Sunday.
I'll have new glasses.
All right. Bye-bye. Have a good night, everybody.